Good evening. Welcome to everyone here. We're going to pick up tonight at chapter 23 of the book of Acts and endeavor to work our way through 23, 24, 25. When we spoke last week at the end of 22, Paul had been taken into custody by the Romans. And,
he had had a first offense against the Jews where they had reacted strongly when he said he was sent away to the Gentiles, and the Romans take him and for his protection. But the Roman commander that had was in custody of him, in charge of him, wanted to know more about why the Jews had against him. And so we close with verse 30, desiring to know the real reason why he has been accused by the Jews. He unbound him, commanded the chief priests and the council to meet, and he brought Paul down and set him before them. And that's where we'll pick up tonight. So here in the beginning of 23, Paul starts out by saying, looks at the council and says, "Brothers, I've lived before my life before God in good conscience up until this day." And as we see, as we go through this reading, just drew a strong reaction from the high priest Ananias, who commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. And Paul reacted to that, as you read in verse 3. "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law? And yet, contrary to the law, you order me to be struck." Those who stood by said, "Would you revile God's high priest?" Paul said, "I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'You should not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" So, before Paul even gets started, some drama occurs in this meeting. And so a question comes up that sometimes people ask is, well, did Paul know that he was the Lord's high priest? And why did, you know, he say what he did? And I don't know that I can answer that, but I can give you, some thoughts. One is that this was an informal meeting, evidently. It was called quickly. It says on the next day, the commander wanted to know why. He brought them together. Perhaps the high priest would not have normally been at such a meeting, and in this case he was there. He may not have been robed in his, you know, high priestly garments, and so it may have been that Paul didn't recognize that that's who that was, and so that's possible. Another suggestion is that Ananias was not in the position of the high priest in the proper way. In other words, he had usurped that position. And so he really was not the high priest according to the way it was intended that one would become a high priest. And so in that light, Paul says, you know, to him, "I did not know that he was a high priest." Could have been sarcastic. He might have known he was in that position, but in a sarcastic way he may have said, basically saying he's not really the high priest. So there's a couple of ideas there that may explain this interchange. The idea of striking, you know, ordering Paul to be struck. Paul's statement was, "All my life I've lived in good conscience," and certainly to the Jew who was engrossed in the law of Moses and rejected the salvation of Christ and the law of Christ. Certainly for Paul to have said that would not have been taken well, because he did not look at Paul as having lived in a good conscience. So that may have been the strong reaction on his part. Nonetheless, you know, what Paul has to say to them gets off to a shaky start because of this interchange involving Paul and the high priest. But then Paul, it says in verse 6, perceived that one part was Sadducees and the other Pharisees. And so from your reading, you see what happens here. And Paul makes a statement that it's because of the hope of the resurrection of the dead that he's on trial. And so this strong argument broke out between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. So much so that the Pharisees said in verse 9, "We find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or an angel had appeared to him?"
Before you go too much further, I have a question.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to charge Paul with a lack of love or unchristlike spirit because of what he said? Does that have proof?
Paul's statement, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest.
The previous statement, God could strike you and you whitewash Paul.
Well, I understand that. But his statement in verse 5, I did not know, brothers, that he was a high priest. Either he didn't know it, and his idea, the words there, to revile not, you know, the high priest from the law, or he didn't know it, but knew he was in that position illegitimately and was being sarcastic about it. I would answer that by saying, no, it's not wrong on his part, not wrong to call him a whitewashed wall. For one thing, we've got the example of Jesus' teaching in Matthew chapter 23. That was to the Pharisees. Some of these would have been Pharisees in this group. The Sadducees were probably not much better. I don't know if Paul was speaking by inspiration at this point or not. I don't know. Certainly, if it was inspired, it would be the words of God saying this. But I can't answer if he was inspired. But no, I don't think it was wrong. His point was, why he said that is in the latter part of verse 3. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law you order me to be struck? So that was the hypocrisy that Paul was drawing out. Punishment under the law was one thing, but punishment under the law without first being convicted was something else. Paul had not been convicted of anything. He had been accused. And what he had been accused of in every account was wrong. We will discuss that as we get further. So certainly he had not been convicted of anything. And secondly, if he had been convicted, it would not have been by an honorable court. And we'll see that as we go along. So he brings these two groups against each other. And in verse 9 it says, such a clamor arose, such a violent confrontation between these two groups arose. The tribune in verse 10, the commander had to step in, and for Paul's own safety, had to pull Paul apart from them. So here you've got both Jewish groups fighting over Paul. One, perhaps, to release him. The other, to keep him in bondage. So the commander of the Roman group there steps in, and his soldiers by force take him away to the barracks for his own safety. Now, just imagine the effect that this would have on Paul. Obviously, he's been treated poorly, even to the point of death, many times already in his service unto God. So, you know, being spoken against, even being treated harshly, is not something that has not happened to Paul before. He knew he was going to go to Jerusalem. That was his plan. God had assisted him in getting there. He had made the statement that we've talked to back in chapter 19 and verse 21 that he wanted to go to Spain, Rome, and in the book of Romans in chapter 15, which was written probably before this time, maybe just between 1 and 2 years before this time. He had said that he wanted to go to Rome on his way to Spain. So certainly Paul had his own plans of what he wanted to do. And remember when Agabus, in the beginning of chapter 21, and others where he had landed at Tyre, had come to him and said by the Spirit that he was going to be bound in Jerusalem if he went. So Paul was aware of of these things that were going on in Jerusalem. But certainly he would have felt really discouraged here. Now remember in the 18th chapter when he was in Corinth, the Lord came to him and told him that he would be protected, for the Lord had many people there. And so here again the Lord comes to him and he says, "Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome." Now to my knowledge, this is the first time that he's been told by the Lord that he is indeed going to go to Rome. Up until this point, so far as I know, it's been what Paul has been wanting to do from his assessment of what needed to be done. But certainly, if he has or hasn't before, he's been told at this point that he's going to go to Rome. Now, remember we had looked earlier, too, in Romans chapter 15, and talked about Paul's prayer. His prayer had two points to it. One is that he would be spared when he went to Jerusalem. And the second, that he'd be able to take the alms that had been collected for the saints in Jerusalem. And so we know that his life was spared because he got to Rome. So in that sense, his prayer was answered. But it wasn't answered in the sense that he would not have difficulty in Jerusalem and there would not be plots against him. So here, beginning in the 12th verse of this chapter, we see another plot that's made against him. And here are some men, more than 40, the scriptures say, who plotted to ambush Paul and kill him. Now, what does the scripture say about how determined they were in this effort? I'm sorry? They were not going to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. So they were serious. Now, I believe in the providence of God. And here in the next few verses, you'll see what I believe to be God's providence. Because in verse 16, Paul's nephew, the son of his sister, heard their ambush and came and told Paul. And through the next few verses, the commander of the tribune finds out about it. And then beginning in 23, he makes plans to immediately, that very night, send Paul to Felix, the governor in Caesarea. So that happens. We find out, too, this commander's name is Claudius Lysias. And he writes a letter to take him to the governor for the governor to listen to the charges against Paul and determine what needed to be done against him. As I read the accounts of the governor, I mean of the commander Claudius Lysias, and of the first governor Felix, and of the second governor Festus, it seems to me that this is the only man that doesn't really seem to have a political motivation in what he does. And the other two men, the two governors, you can see politics written all over what they do. But in this man, you don't seem to see that. At least I don't see it in the context. He seems to be interested in having justice served and determine if Paul is guilty of something or if he's not guilty of something. But in the meantime, he's going to protect Paul until that can be determined. And then with this plot for Paul's life, he sees that he may not can, in effect, I'll use the term, guarantee Paul's life. So he sends him on to Caesarea. And so they leave that night, the scriptures say, about 9 p.m. And when he arrives in Caesarea, the letter is given to Felix. And in verse 35, he says, "I'll give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And then he was guarded there in Caesarea. Any comment or anything on chapter 23 before we move on? Yes, Jim.
Why do you think that he had
I think because he took exception to Paul's statement that he had lived in all good conscience.
Right. But what about that, Paul?
Because I would say that the high priest, in his estimation of what we'll see later as we get into say, chapter 24, where Paul is referred to as one who stirs up riots, a ringleader, a sect of the Nazarenes, chapter 24 and verse 5. He pictures Paul in this way. Picturing Paul in that way, he could not have lived in a good conscience if his thoughts about Paul were true. So I think he reacted based on his perception of what Paul was guilty of. I'm sorry?
I see pride there, too. You know, the Jewish people accused him and said that's what he did. And it's almost like, you know, grand jury has made their decision.
Well, you could probably talk about pride. You could probably talk about arrogance. Matter of fact, some of the writers who discuss this high priest, when they talk about him having usurped this office, also talking about him being an extremely vile person, not the person that you would think even spiritually would be in that office. So when Paul referred to him, you know, what was the term he used, whitewashed wall, you know, clean looking on the outside but filthy on the inside, may have had reference to what he was really like, you know, his vile character. Mark?
I think you mentioned Matthew 23, where Christ condemns the Pharisees.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting, in the second verse of 23, he tells them that he said they sit and mow the sea.
They shouldn't what?
They sit and mow the sea, so whatever they say, obey it other than they speak Scripture.
Uh-huh.
The things that Moses spoke, that you see up further up in Matthew. In Matthew, when they come where John is baptized, and John calls them the Bible, is a sign of the fact that they sent him over the sea. So he speaks in a way that, I couldn't say revile, he just spoke truth about him. And yet they sat in Moses' seat. John didn't sin. Think about Jeremiah 23. Jeremiah speaks against the priests and the prophets and all of Israel. And we know earlier that under the writings of Moses, that the whole people were a congregation, as we mentioned the last class of theocracy, and they were a people of God, and yet when they did evil, they were spoken against.
But let's keep something in mind. When you go to 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 1, it talks about not rebuking an elder sharply, you know, an elder person, okay? There's certain aspects, you know, certain people in our society that we need to treat with a degree of respect. They may not have earned that respect, but due to age differences, we need to give respect. Notice the respect that David gave to Saul. Saul didn't deserve the respect David gave him, but he was God's anointed. So he gave him the respect of being God's anointed. Paul's reference from the Old Testament about to not speak evil, there was an intent in that when it was given. But somehow, either Paul didn't know that, or who this man was, or he knew this man really didn't deserve to be in that position, and so the respect was not due. That still doesn't authorize a person just to lash out in an uncontrolled sense of anger. I don't see the anger in Paul right here. What I see in Paul is that he knew what was being done to him. He knew what the Jews were after. He understood their, as we call it, mode of operation, and they were really after his life. But he knew they were going about it against the law. He knew what the law required, as both from the Jewish law, and he also knew from the Roman law what was required. And Paul works this, and I don't mean work it in a manipulative way. That's not my point. But he's aware of this all the way up until his appeal unto Caesar. So I think Paul was in effect assessing this man in an accurate way, but not in an angry and malicious way. So as we move into chapter 24, 5 days later, the high priest, some of the elders, and a spokesman, Tertullus, come down, and they lay their case against Paul. Tertullus begins to accuse him. And in verse 5, there's three things they say concerning Paul. He says, we found this man a plague. Okay, why is it plague? Well, first, he stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world. Secondly, he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And third, he even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. Now, initially, in Acts 21, the Jews had accused him of profaning the temple. They had accused him of taking Trophimus into the temple. That was the Ephesian that had accompanied Paul. Now, it's not saying that he had done that, but that he tried to do that. And of course, Paul answered that earlier, but he'll have opportunity to answer it again. Now, this idea of the sect of the Nazarenes, a sect is basically a derisive term. It's not a complimentary term. And the idea is this is a group of people who have broken off from Judaism. They're a part of Judaism. Judaism is their base, but they've broken off from it. So, in effect, the term sometimes is used as a splinter group, a party, a dissentious group. But they still consider them a part of Judaism by the use of this term. And we'll see in a little bit that Paul rejects the use of that term. But Tertullus goes on to say, by examining him yourself, you'll be able to find out from him about everything of which we accused him. And then the Jews with him joined in the charge, affirming those things. And Paul was given permission to speak, and he says in verse 11, and he says this to the governor, he says, you can verify that it's not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem. So he had spent, you know, one day getting there, meeting the James, and the next day the elders, the people who greeted him, and the next day James and the elders. And then he took on this this purification process that was to last up to a week, and it got interrupted at some point. And then the incident happened where the guards rescued him, and that involved a night or so. And then another night, he's come down to Caesarea. And then 5 days have passed. So you can see about all this time has been accounted for, you know, rather easily. And he says, in response to one who stirs up riots, he says, in these 12 days, they didn't find me disputing, in verse 12, with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple and the synagogue or in the city. I wasn't stirring up a crowd. I wasn't causing a riot, a dissension, a confusion. It's ironic that Paul would be accused of this. When you go back to Antioch of Pisidia in Acts 13, who caused the dissension there? It was the Jews. When he went to Iconium, who caused the dissension and the turmoil? It was the Jews. When he went to Lystra, it was the Jews from Antioch and Iconium who followed him there. So it wasn't enough just in their own city. They followed him. And in Thessalonica, the same thing. In Acts 19, it was the Gentile Ephesians, the riot that Demetrius, a silversmith, started. So in every place he's been, a riot has been started by somebody, in most places the Jews, but never by Paul, because that's opposed to reasoning. That was the way Paul worked, not by stirring up some emotional fervor. That's what riots do. Remember, we made that comparison in Acts 17, the way Paul reasoned and the way those Jews who were jealous of him worked. You know, one used logical reasoning processes. The other strove to stir up trouble. And so the way they worked is entirely different. And so he says, neither can they prove what they say, now against me. In 14, he answers the second thing concerning the sect of the Nazarenes. He says, according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets. This idea of the way is a term that was used previously in Acts chapter 9. Paul had letters to go to Damascus to persecute those belonging to the way. Well, it's ironic, see. He was persecuting those belonging to the way. Now he himself is being persecuted for belonging to the same way. I don't know how the term the way got started. There's a couple of uses of it that I'm not trying to associate with this. I'm not trying to say these were precursors for the use of this term, the way. But you remember in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 17, you know, there's the broad gate and the broad way, the narrow gate and the narrow way, and few that find it. And John 14 and verse 6, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the Father but by me. The way of the truth that leads to life, you see. And it fits, but I'm not suggesting that's a precursor of this term. But certainly this concept of the way is used in several places in the Scriptures. And so he says, according to the way, which they call a sect. In other words, we're not a splinter group. We're not Judaism or trying to reform Judaism, trying to revamp Judaism. You remember in the Restoration, in the Reformation movement, Martin Luther was trying just to correct some things within the Catholic Church, you see. He was trying to reform the Catholic Church. He wasn't trying to start a Lutheran denomination, you see. He wanted to correct Catholicism. Well, Paul is not trying to correct Judaism. That's not it at all. This is not trying to remake Judaism. So it's not a splinter group off of Judaism. But this is instead the way to life through Jesus, which the law of Moses did not provide. So there's no way the law of Moses could be revamped. No way Judaism could be revamped. And then he goes on to say, having a hope in God concerning these things that are written in the law and prophets, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. Here Paul acknowledges, and for those religions today that teach otherwise, there will be a resurrection that involves the just and the unjust. So he says, I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now remember, the same man, Ananias, is here that rejected Paul's statement in chapter 23 when Paul said, I've tried in my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. He tried to live that way. And so to this same Ananias, or before this same Ananias, Paul makes this, you know, a similar statement, but he words it differently. He says to always take pains to have a clear conscience. And what I want to bring out to you is having a clear conscience is not easy. It takes work to have a clear conscience, because the allurement of doing wrong is strong. The allurement to go against what we know is right is hard, is strong, and we yield to that. What Paul is saying is, I've refrained from yielding to those things. I've taken pains. I've gone through whatever it took to keep me from going against my conscience. Now, obviously, it's been discussed many times, it doesn't mean the conscience is right. The conscience has to be trained properly. But when the conscience, whatever the way the conscience is trained, when we go against that, that conscience nags at us. It's telling us, you're not living the way you should live. Something's wrong. And so that's why we need the Word of God to train our conscience, so that we can live not only with a good conscience, but live in before God in a manner that's pleasing unto Him. So he says, I've always taken pains to have this clear conscience. Now he addresses a third point, and that is trying to profane the temple. He says, now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. So this gives, you know, a purpose of this trip to Jerusalem, why he came. He says, while I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple. I'm not out causing a riot. You see, I'm in the temple. I've been going through a purification process. They accused me of trying to trample the law of Moses and disrespect Moses. No, I'm going through a purification process, which is spelled out in the law of Moses. He says, there's no crowd, there's no tumult, but there's some Jews from Asia. And if you go back to chapter 21, it was those Jews from Asia that stirred up the crowd there in Acts 21 while Paul was in the temple. And he says here, they're the ones that ought to be before you. They ought to be here making the accusations, because they're the ones that you know, have brought all of this up. any this concludes, or else let these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before their council, other than this one thing, that I cried out while standing among them, is respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you this day. And so that was a statement in 23, when those Pharisees and Sadducees, when they started fighting with one another, Paul had said, it is respect to the hope and resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial. And Paul keeps before his audience, in one way or another, the resurrection of the dead. Obviously, the resurrection of the dead has no meaning without the resurrection of Christ. The resurrection of Christ has no meaning, but that Christ came, that Christ suffered, and that Christ died. And of course, none of that has meaning except that Christ would be a suitable sacrifice. He'd come down from heaven, live the way God wanted him to live, and availed himself to be that sacrifice for our sins. And thus, he was raised from the dead, giving us hope of our salvation. And thus, Paul said, he says, it's respect to the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial. As this continues on, it says, Felix had some knowledge of the way, and he put them off, saying, when Lysias, the commander of the tribune, comes down, I would decide your case. So evidently, Lysias was going to bring this commander from Jerusalem back down and was going to discuss it with him. I don't know if that ever happened. We don't have record of that happening. Perhaps had that happened, Paul might have been released. The commander may have said, I didn't find anything wrong with him. I didn't see where he caused any of the things he's been accused of. He might have been released. However, we don't have record of Lysias coming down. And so he gave orders to the centurion that he should be kept in custody, but given liberty, and his friends should be able to come see him. Now, after some days, it says in verse 24, Philip came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish. He sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ. And in some verses you're familiar with, he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the coming judgment. Felix was alarmed or terrified and said, go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you. At the same time, he hoped that money would be given him by Paul. So he sent for him and conversed with him often. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. This idea of Felix coming to him and Paul reasoning with him concerning righteousness and self-control and judgment. You remember, if you go back to John 16, Jesus said that that's what the Spirit was going to come to do. It was going to give them the means, you see, to bring a person to righteousness, to talk about self-control and the judgment to come. And this was going to be, you know, the work that the Spirit was going to enable the apostles. And so here is Paul picking up on those same points that Jesus said. But there's something about this man. Now, I'll give you a little bit of history about this man as I understand it. It's not here in the Scriptures. But Felix was a rough character. He was governor. It's my understanding that he had grown up as a slave, became a governor. His evil was to the point that Drusilla was supposedly very young. It's reported that she's about 20 years old at this point. She had gotten married at 16. She was supposedly very beautiful. And she had married a king of a very small country. And Felix hired a sorcerer to go deceive her, that she should leave her husband and come marry him. And she did. Now, it says in verse 27, when 2 years had elapsed, he was succeeded by Porcius Festus. History says that the reason he left that position after 2 years was because of the way he had treated the Jews there in Caesarea and perhaps in some other places, but the committed atrocities against the Jews because, as the Jews might squirmish with the Romans or something, he was very heavy-handed against the Jews. And it's also reported that some Jews were going to travel to Rome to testify against him, and he enticed them not to go by leaving Paul in prison, as it says at the close of the 27th verse. So you see the politics here. And as a result of his going to Rome and being tried there, he was exiled, and was no longer in the picture as we would consider. Now that's what history says about this man. Now I say that to say this: when Paul reasons with him in verse 25 about righteousness and self-control in the coming judgment, you see what Paul was reasoning against. He wasn't reasoning with a moral man who just needed to learn about Christ. He was reasoning with a man who was very immoral and would work things to work in his favor. So I don't know if Paul knew how he was going to react. I don't know if Paul knew that he was going to, you know, continue to listen to him. And as we see, his listening, you know, certainly after the initial conversation, didn't seem to be in the sense of wanting to know about the way, but hoping for a bribe, which, as I would understand, never happened. But understand, Paul having to, I say having, I don't mean in that sense, but Paul discussing the scriptures with a man such as this, who had the authority just to have him put to death, just to turn him back over to the Jews and let the Jews take care of him, because they wanted to put him to death. And he could have washed his hands of it, as Pilate had done some years earlier. Now, you know, let's look at something else about Paul. Paul could have reasoned in such in another manner. We don't have any record of these 2 years that Paul's in prison, of any preaching he did, any teaching that he did, any letters that he wrote, or any such a thing. I'm not saying he did or didn't write letters. I don't know. I don't know what he did. But he was here, you know, in some type of detention for these 2 years. And perhaps people could come and go, and he could converse with people. But certainly he was restricted. Paul might have reasoned in this manner. Look at all the good I could do if I could be away from here. I might get to Rome earlier. I might make my way to Spain, you see. I might be able to go out and go on another journey someplace else. Look at the good I could do. So let's pay this bribe. We probably don't have to pay him very much. There's plenty of Christians that would help in this. These men with me can go back to Asia and, you know, and raise some money. Let's have them go do that. But we don't see that happening. We don't see Paul looking at his imprisonment that way. It reminds me of what Micah said in chapter 7 and verse 7. He says, "I will wait on the Lord of my salvation." And Paul has been told, "You're going to go to Rome." And Paul says, "That's good enough. God's in control. Whatever's happening to me right here, I'll be patient and I'll wait on the Lord." Joseph was another man as such an example. "I'll be patient. I'll be in prison. I'm still going to serve the Lord. I'm not going to deny Him. I'm not going to do what's wrong." And so we need to do that in our lives. When we see our life not going the way that we think it ought to go, yet we're still trying to serve God, well, maybe it's just a chance for us to grow and mature and develop. And let's wait on the Lord and not do those things that would be sinful in order to change what, you know, the conditions that we're under. In chapter 25, Festus begins to... he arrives on the scene, and almost immediately he goes to Jerusalem to find out about Paul. And one thing now, keep Festus in mind. See, the Jews have been in turmoil against Felix. So Festus comes in, and now he wants to smooth over the rough relationship between the Jew and the Roman. So now he's going to be inclined to do the Jews a favor also. So, you know, we've got the motivation on his part from that perspective. And so the chief priest and the various principled men, they lay out their case against Paul. But what they really want to do is for Festus to bring him to Jerusalem, because they've got an ambush they're going to set up to take his life. Well, Festus, though, doesn't do that. He says, "No, y'all come down here to Caesarea and you can argue your case there." And so that happens. In verse 7, they arrive. In verse 8, Paul argued his defense. He says, "Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense." In other words, Paul is saying, not against anybody. not against these Jews over here accusing me, not against Festus, your Roman government, not against either one of you have I done anything that's wrong. And Paul understood when Festus asked him, do you want to go back to Jerusalem? Paul understood that if he went back to Jerusalem, he would be killed. So Paul says, I'm standing where I ought to be tried. I'm a Roman citizen. I'm standing before Caesar's tribunal. This is where I should be. And so based upon that, he says, I appeal to Caesar. If I've done wrong, then I'm willing to die. I haven't done wrong. I want to appeal my case to Caesar. And so that was, you know, the arrangement. And so after some days had passed, Agrippa the king and Bernice comes. They stay there for many days. And Festus is in a quandary. He's going to present Paul to Caesar, but he doesn't know what to charge him with. He doesn't know what to say he's done. He needs to have a charge against him. So he's hoping now that Bernice can listen to Paul's case and decide something about, you know, maybe help him in writing his letter to Caesar. And so they have this arrangement with great pomp. It says in verse 23, Agrippa and Bernice come in. And in verse 24, Festus says, King Agrippa and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish nation petitioned me, both in Jerusalem here, shouting that he ought not live any longer. But I found that he had done nothing deserving death, and he himself appealed to the emperor and decided to go ahead and send him. But I have nothing definite to write to him. Therefore, I brought him before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after examining him, I may have something to write. For it seems unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charge against him. And just looking ahead at the close of chapter 26, as these men have listened to Paul, Agrippa says in verse 32 to Festus, this man could have set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. So the Jews could not prove their charges against him. They could only make unfounded accusations that were based on prejudice, based on jealousy. Claudius Lysias, the commander of the forces, had nothing evil to say of him. Felix, the first governor, had nothing evil to say of him. Festus, the second governor, had nothing evil to say of him. And now King Agrippa has nothing evil to say of him. So here, you know, by these four groups within the Romans, who certainly would be impartial as to the judgment of him, all say that he was innocent. Now, for the next two classes, I want us to take chapters 26, 27, and 28. So for the reading on for the next class, please read the next three chapters to finish the book. Are there any questions that we have? You got a few seconds before Tracy gets back to the buzzer. Okay.